Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is January 11th, and this is the shortest amount of time I have ever waited to start recording something for mass consumption. Shortest time I've waited to do so after waking up ever. I woke up, I'm not even kidding, 8 minutes ago. 9 minutes ago, I was asleep. Anyway, I'm not recording a whole show right now. This is just an intro. What you're going to hear on the show, what you're going to hear on the rest of the show today is my discussion with Stefan Molyneux from last Saturday. The second half of the show, I brought in a co-host, Jason Osborne, and he had some parenting questions for Steph, so that made up the rest of our discussion. I do have video of this on our YouTube channel. Of course, Steph does as well, but I managed to, over the course of the last week, take our video, Steph's video, and our audio and cut it all together in a little bit more of an active presentation. So maybe you could check that out. I don't know. It's on our website, too. That's something you should do. You should go to schoolsucksproject.com. At least poke around. Just a poke here and there. If you have a few minutes, make an account. Maybe make a forum post. Maybe share some links. Maybe suggest some show prep. It's all easy to do on the new site. I look forward to your feedback. Thanks for listening. Take care. Oh, well, hey, Osborne.
Hey.
All right, we're starting again, and in the studio with me, you know my regular co-host on the show, Jason. We talked earlier in the day, and you were saying that you might have some questions for this man about parenting.
Here's a question for you, Steph. How do you deal with Christmas at your house? In terms of presents and the daughter and all that surrounds that ritual.
I'm not sure I follow the question. I want to make sure I'm answering something specific.
Okay.
I mean,
so,
we have a regular old Christmas. My daughter's birthday is close to Christmas, so I've explained to her that most of the cheap people in her life will only ever give her one present, and it's a thief that Father Time will maybe pay her back with overtime. But that's just something she's going to have to deal with over time. But, you know, we get a tree. We put up the tree. We put on Michael Bublé's Christmas album sometimes, and enjoy the lights and all that. So yeah, we've got presents under the tree, and I mean, we've explained to her, you know, she sees Santa everywhere, and of course she knows that it's a fun story, right? Because we go through the logic of how it couldn't possibly happen, but it's a fun story, and she enjoys her presents, and you know, we have parties and all that, friends over. It's a very relaxed and enjoyable time. So that's sort of how it works in our household. Again, if there's any hiccups in yours, I'd certainly be happy to, you know, lend you my amateur vocals.
Yeah. So 2 years. So my daughter is turning six next month. And 2 years ago, Christmas, we had set what I find to be a dangerous precedent of, you know, having presents on Christmas. And 2 years ago turned into just 2 months worth of crazy trauma over the anticipation of waiting for these presents. It became completely unbearable, such that last year we just said, forget it. And we ended up doing the presents 2 weeks early. And then this year we ended up doing the presents 4 weeks early, just to get it over. We couldn't handle it anymore.
Right.
And is that anything like that that you've experienced with your daughter, or?
Children, particularly around the age of 3 and 4, I mean, they're fiendish materialists, and their sense of gratification deferral is measured in the subatomic nanosecond range. And so I generally work with a 10 to 20 to 1 ratio. So 2 weeks for a kid is like 40 weeks for you. And 40 weeks is like, well, if you have them here, why would I wait for 40 weeks? for something that's great. And certainly if the government, like if a store said, you know, well, thank you for the refund, we will ship you a check in 40 weeks. You'd be like, well, no, sooner if you, we've got the money, we're just going to wait for 40 weeks to send you the check. That would probably be kind of annoying for you if the government said, your refund check is in the mail, it will be there in just under a year. You'd be like, well, you've got the money, you can type it into the computers if you want. So I think just recognizing that from a child's standpoint, you know, shiny baubles, toys and that are hugely fun to play with. And their sense of time is very different from that of an adult's. And I think that's sort of a, just a basic thing to understand there. You know, that the horizon for when things are going to happen is pretty short. Like, you know, my daughter can get sort of the day after tomorrow, kind of. She gets that that's not too far away. But, you know, you ask her to estimate things, you know, like, you know, how long do you think it will take for, you know, the eggs to boil, you know, like 30 days. you know, it's all pretty abstract. So I think that's, and of course, remember that Christmas is, for kids who have no sense of a calendar, Christmas is a completely arbitrary deferral. It makes no sense to them whatsoever, right? So it's like, I have these toys, but I'm not going to give them to you for a month. Right. It's cruel for children, and they're going to protest that.
Right, that's
right?
What
I mean,
it came down to.
It's just cruel. So, I mean, there's a couple of things you can do. Of course, you can get them little presents, like little dinky presents to open every day leading up to it. You can sit down and spend half a day explaining, you know, why that has to wait. You can give them their presents early and then give them another present or two little ones to open up under Christmas, on Christmas and so on. But yeah, kids are, you know, they're fiendish materialists and they're kind of bottomless holes of consumption, right? So I was just sort of making a joke. I had to go get a key made today. And, you know, when we were last in the hardware store, my daughter saw one of these little rainbow keys. And she desperately wanted it, and I wasn't going to buy her a rainbow key. But anyway, she was so charming that the guy at the key counter just gave her that, which I thought was nice. And I sort of pointed it out. I said, you know, do you remember that rainbow key we got here? You were desperate for it, like you would have gone to the ends of the earth. You know, here, take my hand, you know, cut it off at the wrist. Just give me that rainbow key. It's oxygen for me. It's blood to a vampire. If I don't have that, I will surely die. And, you know, 2 days later, she didn't even know where it was. Right? So reminding kids of the transient nature of their fiendish desires is, I think, really important. I mean, it's a way of building empirical evidence, right? To me, all conflicts to do with childhood are almost completely solved by repetitive preparation for it, right? So if you get stuff for your kid and they, as they inevitably do, they're dying for it. And then, you know, a day or two later, they don't even know where it is. You point this out to them repeatedly. Point this out to them repeatedly, not in a way to sort of shame or humiliate them or say, I told you weren't going to, you know, play with that thing forever, but just to point out. So then the next time they want something, you can say, hey, remember we talked about this thing you wanted and then didn't play with? Remember this thing we talked about? I think this might be the same kind of thing. What do you think? And they can sort of talk about it and you can sort of whittle them off that, you know, that almost epileptic seizure of materialism that grabs them so strongly that they just desperately have to have that thing. And if they don't have that thing, they're just never going to be happy. To just remind them that they've had this a whole bunch of times before and they haven't really kept that same desire for stuff. So I think it's a lot about preparation. But yeah, just remember, it's like, you know, I have your toy, but I'm not going to give it to you until infinity days have passed. I mean, that for a child, I think is just, it is kind of like a torture for a time marker that is completely arbitrary and incomprehensible to a four-year-old. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Aside from the time aspect too, there's also the expectation and the sense of entitlement that I think the whole charade instills. Like, I remember when I was a little kid, the whole Christmas thing really turned me into kind of an asshole because I wanted certain things, and if I didn't get them, then, you know, screw you
people.
Come on,
give yourself some credit. You might have been an asshole before that came
yes,
along. I mean, just, you know,
I feel like it was the Christmas that turned me into an asshole, though. Like, I feel like right. I might not otherwise have been one. And I see that with my kids too. They're, you know, I want this. Like, well, maybe.
And sugar does it too, right?
Maybe, I don't know.
Sugar makes
people
hyper.
Yeah. My daughter's a bit of a sugar fiend, so that can
happen to her. We keep that away as much as possible.
Right. Okay. So not so much a case with you, but what do you mean when you say entitlement? I just want to make sure I understand that the way you're using that phrase or that word.
Like, I deserve presents and people will give them to me and they will give me what I want because that is the way it's supposed to be.
Right. 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 I mean, is that not true? Aren't people supposed to give them presents that they want when those days arrive?
Well, that's the culture that has been bred, but I don't know that that's
No. They wouldn't get that message unless you as the parent gave it to them, right? I mean, presents are clearly supposed to be given to kids on their birthday, right? That's what, and Christmas or whatever, right? And you as a parent would have communicated that to your kids. Oh, it's your birthday. We're going to have presents or we're going to have cake or whatever, right? So it's not entitlement if you tell them that's how it's supposed to be, if that makes any sense. Okay. Like if you say, you need to sleep in your bed, it's not entitlement if they say, well, I have to sleep in my bed. I mean, that's just following the rules that have been set down by the parents or the expectations that have been set down by the parents. And clearly the gifts are supposed to be to make the child happy. And to make the child happy, you have to give a gift that the child will like. So it seems to me that these would have been things that you would have communicated to the child rather than sort of an innate entitlement that they would have because of the event. Does that make sense?
Sure. I don't know if we're speaking the same language, I guess, but my intention was not to blame the kid, but to blame the parents for causing this to happen.
But
and,
sorry,
and
what's,
to suggest that
so
this
what's
would
the blame?
Not otherwise
entitlement,
happen.
Because you said asshole, right? So the entitlement is a rational expectation that is set by the parent. So you can't really, obviously, that's not a negative thing. But is it that there's no gratitude? Is that what you sort of feel?
Right.
So the kid just like, hey, I'm going to get my presents. They better be great presents. And if they're not great presents, I'm going to be like really upset. So there.
Right.
Right.
And it seems like regarding the one specific event might spill over into one's attitude toward other aspects of life as well.
Right. Like there's just this conveyor belt of good things that come my way and I don't have to lift a finger and that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
Can I ask a question? What kind of exposure do they have to media, your two kids?
Dora the Explorer.
Okay. So Nickelodeon.
A little bit of that. Mostly they watch How It's Made and Mighty Machines.
Mighty Machines. So it's programmed geared towards their age group.
But commercials too, I would assume, right?
Yeah. Because this is something that I think we often overlook, certainly as far as our coverage of it. I mean, I just talked about it for the first time on the last show, was marketing to young people. And, you know, the science and the resources and the money, the psychological research that has gone into turning children into, you know, consumers. Now, I think children, John Taylor Gatto pointed out 20 years ago that children and addicts are two groups that don't necessarily understand when to stop consuming something. And, you know, the goal of school was to turn to everybody into children or to stop them from growing up. As far as the marketing is concerned in youth marketing, there used to be a real clear differentiation when I was watching TV when I was a kid is like, this is the show and this is something else, right? This is the Smurfs. This is a guy selling cars, you know. One is an animated, blue, living under a mushroom, can't read so good kind of thing. The other is Bob from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and he's got a car dealership. But today, there is virtually no differentiation between the actual program that is there for entertainment and the commercials. In fact, a lot of the times, it's the same characters that these children love so much through these shows that then come on in those 2-minute breaks to participate in selling stuff to them. So I think that that's another, I mean, it sounded like one of the things that you were talking about, Steph, is the importance of being proactive. And this is one of the things that I've harped on a lot in the past. And it's something that I've, you know, learned from my own experience working with young people. I think it's important to have conversations with children as young as possible about, you know, what the nature of television is and what the purpose of advertising is.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I mean, we've had all those conversations with her starting when she was 2 and 3 years old. But the other thing, too, is that to me, it's always well worth, you know, buying a DVD, which doesn't have commercials rather than television or buying a subscription to a television station that doesn't have commercials. You know, that's going to be a lot cheaper in the long run than having them exposed to a lot of commercials. Because, yeah, as you point out, it's kind of embedded in the shows. And so I think that's important. As far as, you know, the image came to my mind thinking about this issue of generosity, right? So the fear is that if you're really generous with children, then they'll just kind of sit back and expect things to come to them and not reciprocate. But to me, you know, when my daughter was very little and even still now, you know, I'm constantly teaching her new words and teaching her, you know, concepts and sentence structure and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of like saying, well, you know, if you just keep teaching children language, they'll never speak back. Well, they do. I mean, they are very enthusiastic to speak back. And, you know, my daughter's now at the point where she's sort of asking me, you know, if I'm gone for half a day, you know, how did you, what did you do with your time? Where did you go? How did you have fun? Like, she's really asking me lots of questions. So I think if you're generous towards children, what you're doing is you're modeling generosity, and almost in a sort of universally preferable behavior machine that I think children really are, they will simply reflect that back and become generous that way, right? So I've always shared my food with Isabella, and she is very happy to share her food with me. And, you know, I always ask her how she slept and how, you know, if she had any dreams. And now she asks me how I slept and, you know, did I have any dreams? And we'll sometimes act out my dreams sort of in the living room. It's really quite surreal, but a lot of fun. And so if you are generous towards your children, in, you know, open-hearted and give them, you know, within like reasonable things that are useful, instructive, enjoyable, and entertaining for them, they internalize something called generosity. And as long as it's not hooked in with any kind of resentment or conditional and so on, I have found that it really does come back. It is just like a boomerang. It's sort of involuntary the way that happens. There is a phase where it does sort of feel like, oh my God, I give and I give and I give. And that's usually right before it starts coming back. You know, I don't know why that is. It just always seems the moment I get frustrated with my daughter in some particular area, it's right before she changes in some great way. It's really, and I don't think it's as a result of me getting frustrated, but I think if you just are generous, you're actually teaching them what generosity looks like, and therefore they will internalize that in the same way that when you use the correct words for things, they internalize that and then speak those words back to you. So I think just trust in generosity will be reciprocated because you're teaching them what it looks like, and they can't, in a sense, they can't help. You know, my daughter can't help but use the word apple for an apple because that's what she's been taught. And she can't help but share her food and share her toys and be generous and to resolve things peacefully and to want to negotiate with everyone all the time because that's what she's been taught. So I think just trust that the effort that you're putting in, the expenditure, the generosity that you're putting in will be reciprocated. I know it can be tough to trust that at times, but I've certainly found that to be the case.
Can I ask you, how much do you think your relationship with your daughter has benefited from the amount of time that you can actually spend with her? And maybe speak to, you know, a little bit about daycare. Kids often growing up, like I know, Osborne, your wife is around all the time. You work a pretty regular schedule and you have to travel a little bit. But I mean, for a lot of families, it's, you know, the kids don't see their parents pretty much all week. And that's really unfortunate. Yeah.
It's extremely unnatural. It's a great it's one of the greatest tragedies, I think. So historically, and anthropologists have done a fair amount of work on this, and people can find the reference for this, I think, in Chapter 1 of Dr. Philip Zombardo's book, The Demise of Guys. But historically, there was about a 4-to-1 ratio of adults to children when children were growing up, because you'd be on a farm, your parents would be around, you'd have extended family over all the time. There might be many generations living under one roof. I'm not saying that was all ideal, but I'm saying that the way that we developed, the way that we evolved as a species was with a much higher ratio of parents to children. You know, 4-to-1. No matter how many kids you had, there would be about 4-to-1 parents to children. Now that has completely changed. I mean, it's more than reversed, because it's not like we have, you know, 1-to-4 kids to adults. I mean, when your kids go into, you know, school, you know, 20-to-1, 30-to-1, when I worked in a daycare, there were two teachers for about 25 kids aged 5 to 10. And so what's happened? happened is things have more than completely reversed. And now we have 10 to 15 to 20 to 30 or more ratio of children per adult, whereas it should have been quite the opposite, four adults for every single child. And what happens is, of course, children imprint upon those around them. I mean, that's natural. They take their cues, they take their self-esteem, they take their pecking order, they take their instruction, moral, cultural, artistic, you name it, from whoever they're around. We are highly impressionable as a species. I mean, we're like, you know, those that wax that they put that signet ring into, we're just wax. And then culture and philosophy and thoughts and habits and politeness, they all impress upon us very deeply. So children are going to absorb whatever they're around. And unfortunately, we have a society where children are almost exclusively influenced by other children. And children cannot raise children. They can't do it. They're in a million miles away. We don't let six-year-olds babysit our children, but we will put our child into a classroom with 20 or 25 other six-year-olds, one harassed and distracted adult, and then wonder why peer pressure ends up so important and ends up so destructive in a child's life. So, and I was just talking about this the other day with my wife. I mean, my job as a dad is about 90% done. It's about 90% done. I mean, I got a little course correction that goes on. There'll be new information and new situations and so on. But my job as a father is mostly done, because this is my daughter's last year of significant brain development and personality development. You know, by the time she's four, four and a half, five, I mean, it's almost completely done. I mean, it can be changed later in life with great effort and so on, but my job as a parent is mostly done. And the rest of it is just management, a little bit, some tweaking, course correction, and so on. And so I've strongly suggested to people, just find whatever you can do to take that time off and be with your kids when they're growing up. I read a book a long, long time ago. It had a huge influence on me. It's by Daniel Crittenden. It's called What Your Mother Knew But Couldn't Tell You, or something like that. Anyway, people can find it. She's a good writer, and in it she talked about sort of the distant mom. And there was some executive who said, yes, I travel a lot, and I'm at work a lot, but my children know that I'm always with them in their hearts, or in my heart, or something like that. And she said, you know, that sounds exactly like you describe someone who was dead. You know, well, she's always with me in my heart, and so on. And I remember being really struck by that. And, you know, I didn't really want to get kids or get married back in the day. That all changed when I met my wife, of course. But it really is, you know, we take time off from productive earnings to get a college degree or whatever, to travel the world sometimes. You know, take a couple of years off, if you can. I mean, if it's even remotely possible, take a couple of years off. The bond is so incredibly powerful. And there's so much that occurs in parenting that is not concentrated, that is just diluted into the moments and moments. And you never know when the breakthrough is going to happen. You never know when the crisis is going to happen. You never know when the fall is going to happen. So being there as much as humanly possible, I think, is really essential. And I think it's something that really does pay off later, hugely, right? So, I mean, you know, my daughter can, you know, we were at the mall with some friends today. They have daughters, and she just went off with their daughters. I didn't have any concerns about, you know, her getting along or her running off. And she's a very easy child to get along with. She was pretty high maintenance at the beginning, I'll tell you that. I don't know if that's my kid or just in general, but hugely high maintenance to begin with. But now things are very, very easy, and she's a real pleasure. I mean, she's always been a pleasure, but she's a real pleasure to be around. It's a very easy relationship, because there's just so much water under the bridge. So I suggest, if you want to have kids, you know, save up your money, go live with your parents if you have a good relationship, you know, find some way, downgrade, sell your house, live in an apartment for the first couple of years, to have at least one, if ideally both parents present. It really does make an incredible world of difference. It makes parenting so much more fun. I mean, it is, of course, a huge commitment, but I really think that the peace of the world deserves nothing less.
I have one more question. There's something semi-related to this, and I'm just interested in your thoughts. What do you think it is that motivates people to have children? Or is that too general a question? I mean, I think about it for myself.
It's a fantastic question.
Personally, maybe this is kind of a cop-out. I don't think so. But, you know, I look at kind of the world going forward over the next 10 and 15 years, and I don't have any, you know, like, doom or gloom scenario in mind, but I'm just very uneasy about, you know, bringing a young person into what possibly could develop. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but then maybe more generally, why do you think people are they consciously choosing to do this, or is it some biological cue for a lot of people that just like, oh, time to get married, have children?
Well, let's hear from your fabulous co-host while I compose a thought or two.
Why did you have children?
Well, that's an interesting question that we, since we have Stefan on. I was in his boat back in the day. I'd never wanted to have children, and even when my wife and I got married, we didn't want to have children. Mm-hmm. And it was really only after when Stefan started doing his podcast and listening to him for a year or two that I decided like that would be a good idea to go about embarking on that journey.
How about that, Steph?
Well, I appreciate that, and I can only assume that they're named Steph 1 and Steph 2. I also accept UPB or FDR as middle names. But that sort of gives the gives the prompting. I don't think that gives the motivation. Does that make sense?
Sure. Well, I know what was stopping me is I didn't feel like I knew how to do that. Like my childhood was not good, and
right.
I didn't want to insert that on anyone else, right? So I felt like I never wanted to have the children until I knew exactly how I was going to do it.
And this, of course, is one of the frustrations of the planet as a whole, which is that the people who have enough forethought to know that they don't want to reproduce their own childhoods are hesitant to breed. But in a sense, they're the people who should be breeding because they have the greatest capacity to break the cycle. But anyway, just want to mention. So, okay, so let's say I said, you know, well, you know, parenting is fun or you know, there's a lot to be got out of it or whatever. Was there anything in particular that was the primary motivation to deciding to take what is, you know, the biggest commitment you can take outside of marriage?
You know, I don't even know how to verbalize that.
All right. Well, while you think about it, let me start avoiding the personal question with a very, very brief discourse on the motivations that most people have. Most people, of course, they don't know why they want to have kids. Like if you ask them, they say, I don't know, we got married, that's just the thing you do next, or getting pressure from my parents, or the priest said have some babies, or whatever it is. And I think it's really important to understand that childhood and the having of children has fundamentally historically been breed for the benefit of the rulers. I mean if you look at religions, they tend to be against birth control. Why are they against birth control? Because it is easier to indoctrinate than it is to convert, right? So why do Catholics want to have so many children? Why do Muslims want to have so many children? Because that's how you spread, right? So there's a lot of pressure and propaganda from the ruling class to have lots of kids, in the same way that if you have a very fast horse, you want to stud it or breed it. If it's a male horse, you want to breed it off. If it's a female horse, because it's going to make you a lot of money, right? So the breeding of taxpayers, the breeding of religious adherents, the breeding of tithe payers, whatever it is, has been a huge motivational factor for people to have children. And this is why there is this general prejudice. It's like, well, you don't have kids. What's the matter with you? There's something wrong. You should be having children. Children are the best thing ever. You've got to have kids and so on, with no particular reference to empirical studies. The empirical studies show that the children, by and large, reduce the quality of people's life experience and marriage experience considerably. Considerably. I mean, if people just did a little bit of basic research, you know, like I was to say to someone, oh, I went to go and buy an Android tablet. It's like, well, how long did you spend doing the research for that Android tablet? Oh, you know, I was off and on reading websites, a couple of hours, you know, a couple of days kind of thing. It's like, okay, so when you decided to have kids, how much research did you do into whether that was a good idea or not? And if it was a bad idea, under what circumstances was it a bad idea? How could it be better? And how should you discipline your kids? And if you even need discipline, and how, what are you going to do for education? I mean, the average bride, I think I was reading this today, if I remember the numbers right, the average bride spends like 170 hours preparing for her wedding. It's like, dear God, take 20% of that and read parental effectiveness training, or figure out, you know, what mistakes people made that end up with them having such a negative experience of having children. I mean, 1 out of 5 women doesn't even want the child that's coming out of her hoo-hoo in the actual moment. I mean, anyway, it's a complete mess. So, you know, I really encourage people to do the research, to recognize that for the majority of people, having children negatively impacts the marriage, negatively impacts intimacy, happiness, sleep, health. I mean, it's, can generally, according to the studies that are done, it's pretty disastrous for people to have children. And of course, because they resent all of that, the children end up not being very happy and not being treated well and so on. So I think that's an important thing to understand. There's a lot of propaganda around having children, even though having children for the ruling classes generally makes your life a whole lot less fun. And Phyllis Schlafly, the writer, has a big comment about this that's somewhat related, where she says, it's hard for women who have never paid into Social Security to get much back out of it. Although she says, well, I've raised six children and therefore have contributed six taxpaying citizens to the general public rolls. Therefore, I should be getting Social Security because I've produced so much that is of benefit to other people as new taxpayers and so on. And it is, children are a revenue stream. I mean, one of the reasons that Europe is doing so badly is the birth rate is really low. And one of the reasons the birth rate is really low is that there's been such a huge growth in the size and power of the state. So there's a lot of propaganda. I don't think people really think about it at all. It's just the next thing you do. There is, of course, a phase in a woman's 30s where I've sort of heard it described as either feeling like you constantly need to pee or you constantly need to eat, where they just get this baby hunger. And there's that sort of biological drive. I think that people don't really think about it. The research shows that not really thinking about it is a bad idea because you end up less happy than before. And it's not like you can just back out of it kind of easily. So I think it's really important to do that. I mean, I had a kid just because I think life is an incredibly beautiful thing. I am completely overjoyed to be alive. If there's this wonderful and beautiful gift, this thing called life that you can just kind of snap your fingers and create and then spend time nurturing and so on, it is truly a delightful experience to see a mind rise like a skull and bones Atlantis and become sort of full-fleshed, talking, animated, cutesy head with teeth. It is an absolutely, I hate to say it, almost a religious experience to see out of a sperm and an egg and an ultrasound to have a human being come. Michelle Pfeiffer says this in some movie with Nick Cage. It's like there were no people and now there are people. I mean, fundamentally, that's an incredible thing, a mind-blowing thing. There are no people and then there are people. And that's just incredible. I mean, it is like being a little deity, you know, to make people. I mean, it's incredible. I can't even put my wife's treadmill together, but you know, with 3 minutes of bad sex, I can make a baby. I mean, it's incredible. So I think that unbelievably magical, mystical, quasi-astounding, jaw-dropping, there's a person there that there wasn't before. It's just such an astoundingly amazing thing to be part of and to have a hand in guiding if you do the research and you do it right, I think there's nothing better in the world. But unfortunately, most people never do the research, do it pretty wrong. 80 to 90% of parents are still hitting their children. And then they wonder why their lives take a bad turn after they have kids. Well, it's because you're doing wrong. That's why, you know, if you go out and go become a shoplifter, you're not that surprised if you lose some self-esteem points, are you? But if you go around hitting your children, yelling at children, abandoning your children for other people to raise, guess what? You do bad things, you tend to end up unhappy. That's the reason equals virtue equals happiness, trifecta of philosophy, and the opposite is true as well. So if people do the research, do the preparation, and know what they're doing, why they're doing, commit to the non-aggression principle, raise their children peacefully, give extra special rights and privileges and superhumanity with the cherry on top to their kids, it's an incredible experience. But that's really quite the opposite of what most people do, and that is, I think, the central tragedy of our species at the moment.
Really well put. Except for the part where you said skull and bones rising out of Atlantis, our conspiracy theory listeners are going to have a field day with that. But other than that, perfect stuff.
But don't worry, that particular skull and bones did not get any vaccinations and was never exposed to fluoride. So there you go, people.
Now they're definitely going to have a field day with that. All right. Well, yeah. Hey, I want to thank you so much for your time. You want to take a quick minute just to plug your stuff?
Plug my stuff, man. Okay, so follow me down into the back alley, people. Listen, I'm going to open up my trench coat. I got some philosophy here, man. You can snort this stuff. It's good stuff, man.
Do you have pants on while you do this?
It's all high hangover, man. You'll be flying high as a kite, on fire, through the face of the moon, backwards around the sun, looping around. It's going to be like being a condor's ass feather in a high breeze. That's where you want to be. It's going to be like being a seagull in a tornado going round and round, but never hitting the ground. This is the good stuff, man. Mainline it. Take it. FreeDomainRadio.com. We've had almost 50 million downloads. Just one. dare I say, ahead of the inimitable Ron Paul, Tom Woods, and Antonio Beeler, the 2012 Liberty Inspiration Award. You can check that out. I've got the link to on the main page of my website. Read some of the testimonials. I mean, if you doubt the power of philosophy, read some of the testimonials. I think that you'll at least be intrigued, and hopefully will dip your toe into the Elysium streams of reason and evidence. So, yeah, biggest philosophy show the world has ever seen. Massive thanks to the listeners. It's entirely donation-based. The books are all free. The podcasts are all free. Websites is all free. If you like it, you know, kick a few shekels upstream to the starving salmon ahead. That would be great. And hopefully in the next month or two or three, the documentary will be out. It's called Truth. You can go to truthofdocumentary.com soon, I think it is, to check out some of the previews and promos. It's I've got a conference call tonight with the musical production team, which is fantastic. So, that's what's going on. And, of course, for my listeners, if you guys, definitely you, Brett, want to plug what you're doing. I've always been a huge fan of your show, Brett, so make sure that my listeners can hear your tasty goodies, too.
Sure. SchoolSucksProject.com. We just launched a brand new website. I encourage people to go over and make a user account. They can start a group. They can join a group, participate in our forums. Anything you do on that website puts you right on the front page of it. So if you have something that you want to share, you want to get some eyes on, please go to schoolsucksproject.com, make an account, and get involved. And we also have this thing called the AV Club, which is a bonus content section. We have probably approaching 150 hours of unreleased material, quite a wide range of content. We're also into donations, so if people send us $6 a month, $9 a month, they get access to all of that. And watch us on Ustream on Saturdays and participate in that show.
And a quick tip as well, if you're searching for Brett's show, do not put a space between school and sucks, and definitely do not click on the images. It will age you significantly. So I just wanted to mention that. School sucks, just one word. Look for that. Don't put the space in, and do not click on the images. Do not click on the images.
Thanks again. We'll have to do this sometime in the future, and hopefully I can plan to see you in New York in April at, what is that event called?
April the 20th, yeah. And I will also be at the Escape Hatch Conference in Belize in early to mid-March on my website under speeches. People can see my public speeches before. I can't remember how many I did last year, but it was a huge number. And I will be in Belize. And then, I don't know, you're going to Porkfest, Libertopia, that kind of good stuff next year? Or this year, I guess now.
Definitely Porkfest. Yep. I will be there.
All right. Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks to everyone on your side. It was a real pleasure. And have a great night.
All right. Thanks, Steph. Take care.
Bye.